It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Today we explore the guilt new mothers face when trying to breastfeed.
Breastfeed is talked about in terms of success and failure. You know, it's breastfeeding, it's your body, and it's your body's ability to feed your child. There's kind of nothing more personal or intimate than that. So being unable to do that has a very kind of deep sense of personal failure to it.
We'll also explore why low-income mothers often choose formula over breastfeeding. This and more coming up on West Virginia Morning. This week, we're hearing an Inside Appalachia series about breastfeeding. Pediatricians recommend breastfeeding babies for at least a year. And breastfeeding has benefits for mothers, too. Long-term, mothers who breastfeed have a decreased risk of developing breast cancer. They also have better heart health. Some studies even show that moms who breastfeed have a lower chance of developing postpartum depression. But all of this can also put pressure on women. Almost 900 women shared their experience being a mom in a recent survey distributed through social media by West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Many of the women who had tried breastfeeding faced some type of obstacle along the way, and that made a lot of them feel guilty. Here are some of their stories.
I felt guilty leaving my job because I work as a team and all my other coworkers are male. I didn't know how to explain to them that I was leaving to stay at home with my son so I could breastfeed him.
You know, I would get comments from every single side about what I should and shouldn't be doing for her, especially around feeding. That was, I'd have strangers come up to me and ask if I was breastfeeding or brag about how long they had been breastfeeding, which I feel like they totally missed the point on that one.
My son had a very bad latch and it was painful as all get out. I thought it would be this, you know, easy, beautiful thing. And it is a beautiful thing, but often it is not easy.
About 2 months in, I gave up. I was physically and emotionally exhausted. I had postpartum depression, and I know that the pressure from like this breastfeeding and the stress that I felt from trying to make it work was certainly a contributing factor in at least not making my postpartum depression any easier to deal with.
I came to a moment of realizing I actually hate breastfeeding. I really don't like it. In terms of bonding with your child, I wasn't bonding with my child. I resented her, you know, that she constantly needed to eat, that I never got a chance to take a break or rest, that I never got a chance to leave the house or be away from her. And I started asking myself, like, what if I stopped breastfeeding not because I can't, but because I just don't want to? And that was a whole new level of like mom guilt of, you know, you're supposed to want to, you're supposed to be bonding, you're supposed to have these warm, fuzzy feelings around it, you know, but really, I just kind of hated it.
I really cannot stress enough the amount of pressure that I felt that in order to be a good mother to my son, that I have to breastfeed him.
Breastfeeding is talked about in terms of success and failure. You know, it's breastfeeding. It's your body and it's your body's ability to feed your child. There's kind of nothing more personal or intimate than that. So being unable to do that has a very kind of deep sense of personal failure to it.
In that story, we heard from several women sharing their experiences struggling to make breastfeeding work. To hear more from our series about motherhood, check out the latest Inside Appalachia podcast. Find it on wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Breastfeeding rates are lower among low-income women and higher among high-income women, despite research that shows breastfeeding can provide lifelong health benefits to a baby and potentially save new parents money. Carol Lofton takes a look at why the disparity exists.
Andrea Reedy is one of 9 children, and her mom, she breastfed all of them. So when Reedy got pregnant, she wanted to breastfeed too.
So it was just kind of something that I knew was there, knew that I was capable of because I had had, you know, kind of that example of.
Reedy says breastfeeding was also the cheapest way to feed her baby. When she got pregnant, she was working as a nursing assistant. But the long hours were tough to handle in the later stages of her pregnancy, so she quit. Her boyfriend is a teacher.
We were just broke. Like, you couldn't afford formula, but we weren't broke enough to, like, have the assistance, like the WIC and that kind of stuff. And so I just kind of knew it was something that I kind of had to do.
Reedy and her boyfriend didn't qualify for WIC, the federally funded supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. WIC subsidizes the cost of formula. But Reedy had a lot of support from her mom and a friend who is a lactation consultant, and she was able to successfully breastfeed her daughter. But for many low-income women, it doesn't turn out that way. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the more money you earn, the more likely you are to breastfeed and to stick with breastfeeding. Stephanie Carroll is the president of the Appalachian Breastfeeding Network.
We do know that those that are lower income have less access to care, less access to support, may have other things going on. There could be some addictions. There could be abuse going on in the family. So it's several things compacting a lower income.
Carroll says another barrier for low-income women is the lack of paid maternity leave.
We have a lot of people going back to work early.
And women who qualify for WIC are incentivized to feed their babies formula. To qualify for WIC, a family of three must make less than about $39,000 a year. Carol Peterson is a lactation consultant based in Indiana who helps train new lactation consultants around the country. She's also the former chair of the National WIC Association Breastfeeding Committee.
When it was started, back in the 70s, when we actually had our lowest breastfeeding rates, they didn't recognize human milk as a food. They looked at it as formula, giving people boxes of food.
That thinking has changed in the last few decades at WIC.
They started realizing, well, yes, we're giving formula. Yes, we get rebates from formula, but the optimal nutrition for infants is human milk. So they had to make a big change.
But low-income families had become used to feeding their babies formula, and WIC had developed a reputation as the formula giveaway program. Here in Appalachia, a lot of infants, about half of all the babies born in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Ohio, are supported by WIC, according to federal data. Peterson says WIC is implementing a program that will train staff how to support women with breastfeeding in every WIC office around the country.
Let's say you decided you were going to breastfeed and you don't think it's working, which is 90% of what happens. And it means when you walk in the door, let me take you to somebody to help you resolve those concerns and help you to meet whatever your goals are. And your goals may only be until you go back to work, or your goals may be 6 months or a year. But you need somebody there to give you the information in order to meet those goals and not to just offer you formula.
Peterson says the program should help bridge some of the access to care issues that rural low-income women struggle with. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health and Charleston Area Medical Center. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. It's 7:52. Mostly sunny skies today. Highs in the 70s, partly cloudy overnight with lows in the 50s. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the 70s. Chance of rain and thunderstorms tomorrow night with lows in the 50s. Thursday, rain and thunderstorms with highs in the 60s and low 70s. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by Marshall University, presenting the Huntington Summer Music Festival, June 21st and 22nd in Pullman Square, featuring the Ben Patterson Trio. More at marshall.edu. The book Appalachia North by Matthew Ference takes a look at what it means to be from Appalachia and not realize it. He grew up in a part of Pennsylvania that's part of Appalachia, according to the Appalachian Regional Commission, but no one there acknowledged that fact. Eric Douglas spoke to Ference over Skype about the book and his experiences.
Matthew Ferentz describes Appalachian North as a geological, cultural, and a personal journey. It's a memoir. In the book, he talks about how it wasn't until he was a graduate student at West Virginia University that he realized he was Appalachian. His book explores why his family and friends never identified with the region. Ferentz also describes his diagnosis with a brain tumor, which becomes an analogy for the exploration into his roots.
That was the first inkling for that part of the book, is what does it mean to be from north of the Mason-Dixon line, but still fully Appalachian? And then the other part of it was the medical trauma recovery narrative, which was my diagnosis with a brain tumor and surgery and radiation. And in thinking about this book, so I was actually trying to write the former book after I'd recovered and not thinking about writing a memoir about my brain. But that kept wanting to be told as a story. And I realized that figuratively thinking about erosion and geology and the rocks that make us in a figurative sense work together really well, because both understanding myself as an Appalachian and understanding myself after significant medical setback cause you to rethink who you are.
What surprised you when you were writing the book?
One was geological, and it was in talking to my father, who studied geology for a long time, and he was a conservation biologist by career. And I was asking him about the ancient Appalachian Mountains and how they wore down to become what we live in now. And he said, well, we don't live in the mountains. We live in the old Allegheny Plateau. And so all of our relief in the region is erosion downward from a high plateau instead of a big old mountain that had been worn down through time. And for me, that was a surprise. I hadn't realized that. And I hadn't realized that really a great bulk of Appalachia is in that plateau. And that opened up metaphors for me to completely recalibrate that we're not actually climbing mountains, we're coming out of valleys. And there's a beauty to that.
I thought that was interesting too, talking about the ARC, and that, I mean, to a large degree, the ARC controls everything about Appalachia now. And that was a document created 50 something years ago, and even a completely different mindset in the country at the time. Right. So, right.
And I think what's fascinating in looking through some of those original documents and also the reports that come out periodically is the tropes continue that, essentially talk about, you know, the barefoot, dirty, poverty-stricken child and how this program is helping to improve that. And also the original documents are pretty clear that the way forward, and this actually even predates the ARC documents, that the way forward is the exploitation of the natural resources. So the stories themselves control what we can ever imagine ourselves to be. And the ARC is a wonderful thing, and I think a tremendous success in so many ways. But if we don't interrogate the narrative behind it, then we're kind of at risk of always being victimized.
It strikes me as the classic hero's journey. You know, you've had your inciting incident, and then you were off on your path of self-discovery. Do we get to, at the end of it, do we get to the point where you've had a redemptive moment and completed the hero's journey?
I would say yes and no to that. I mean, I think that's a good way of thinking about the structure of the book or the structure of the reflection I'm working through. For me, that climax of the journey or the destination is mostly a recognition that there isn't a destination, and that and I teach this a lot when I'm talking to students, particularly about memoir, but that we live our lives with this expectation of that hero's journey or the Freytag pyramid of arc. And what we actually often recognize is that life itself doesn't have that kind of pathway.
What do you hope your readers take away from the book?
One thing is for readers who are north of the Mason-Dixon line, who are like me, who grew up Appalachian and not knowing it, I want them to recognize and embrace the culture that they are, so that they can be part of that. And then for fellow Appalachians south of the Mason-Dixon line, I hope that it complicates their notions of the region as well. But then my my hopeful readership, I suppose, is for those outside of Appalachia who think they know what we are, to just add another inconvenient piece to the puzzle that doesn't allow us to think the way we always did.
That was Matthew Ferentz, the author of Appalachia North, talking with our in-house author, Eric Douglas. This interview is part of a series of author discussions with authors from the region. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Liz McCormick. I'm Teresa Wills.